Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set here.
Any program about science or scientists today is almost bound to focus on space.
Okay, Houston, the Challenger has landed.
Houston Station, we are ready for the event. Thank you.
Suited up and ready for blast off. It's another Space Boffins podcast with Richard Hollingham and Sue Nelson.
And to mark the 50th anniversary of the UK's first satellite, we can reveal what went on behind the scenes after it was destroyed by an American nuclear test. We'll also be discussing the future of space exploration as entrepreneurs boldly go where no space agency has gone before. And we've bought a satellite.
And we'll also be celebrating the launch of my favourite Mercury astronaut, Scott Carpenter.
13,000 Army, Navy, Air Force and Marine Corps personnel, all standing by for a lone American in a silver space suit.
And our guests this time are Dr. David Baker, editor of the British Interplanetary Society's magazine Spaceflight. David's a former NASA scientist and has very much an inside track on what's going on in space exploration. And we welcome back Space Kate, journalist Kate Arkless-Gray, the woman on a mission to fly in space. And she's due to head off for the launch of the SpaceX Dragon spacecraft to the International Space Station. And I think you both share the view that we're entering a new era of space exploration.
I think that's very true, and we certainly are. There's been a pullback in terms of government expenditure on national programs and international ventures right across the world, and most of the famous projects have taken a big hit.
I think it's quite an exciting time. Lots of new players coming into the fore, and it'll be really interesting to see what they can do on perhaps smaller budgets than the big governmental ones.
Well, we'll talk more about that a little later on.
On April the 26th, 1962, the world's first international satellite, Ariel 1, was launched. It was a success for the UK, who provided the instruments, but only for a few months, as the Americans unintentionally zapped it with a high-altitude nuclear test called Project Starfish. 50 years later, the full details of what happened have emerged with the release of government papers on the matter. Space Boffins has obtained this previously secret archive, and you're about to hear the contents of some of this correspondence, as well as the space curator of London Science Museum, Doug Millard, and the UK Space Agency's David Parker. Doug first, though, explaining how Ariel 1 was a product of the Cold War.
The reason it was launched was Sputnik. If you go back to 1957, the Soviet Union launched the world's first artificial satellite. The shock, particularly in America, was intense. So what the Eisenhower administration made clear was that they wanted to help their allies launch space experiments on their satellites. So Ariel 1 was the first example of an international collaboration, in this case between the US and the UK. So this was all part of the Cold War and the space race.
And it only effectively operated for a relatively short period of time.
Well, Ariel 1, launched in April, functioned very well, by and large, until July of that year. And then the Americans, ironically, exploded a nuclear test, a high-altitude nuclear test. And although that happened on the other side of the world, it did actually affect Ariel, and indeed another very famous satellite called Telstar. A radiation belt was formed around the world. It only lasted for a little while, but that was sufficient to actually knock out a lot of what Ariel was trying to do.
16th of July, 1962. In confidence. I thought I should let you know that Ariel seems to be misbehaving itself. Transmissions ceased on Friday afternoon, July the 13th. They returned about 18 hours later, cut off after about 9 hours, and have returned again today. I do not have a comprehensive picture yet of the situation, but it does appear likely that the period of trouble-free data transmission is coming to an end.
It wasn't an immediate discovery that the Starfish test had caused the problems with Ariel 1. On the contrary, the sort of official papers start off with the scientists saying, oh no, we don't think it's anything, there's any problem at all, and we don't think Starfish is going to cause any problems to our nice little spacecraft. So it was only over a period of time that as the problems got worse with Ariel 1, that the Americans probably realised that this is what had happened, and that there was an explanation of the problems that several spacecraft were having.
Foreign Office, SW1, August 21st, 1962. Confidential. You will have seen from the telegram we have just sent you about Ariel that the Americans did not consult us before announcing that their high-altitude nuclear experiment last month put Ariel out of action. It is not merely the case that they did not consult us about the announcement. They had not even told us that they had come to this conclusion themselves. You will remember that over the August bank holiday, the Office of the Minister for Science sent a couple of experts over to the United States for discussions with NASA engineers about possible causes of failure of Ariel. As the result of these discussions was negative, it is clear that they have now come to the conclusion that their own experiments were responsible for the damage to Ariel. And we think that it was really rather remiss of them not to have told us of their conclusions before announcing them to the world.
There's one paper which I noticed, and it was a response from the Minister for Science of the day, Lord Hailsham, to the Prime Minister, Macmillan. And the language used was wonderfully Shakespearean. And the Minister for Science was lapsing into some wonderful Shakespearean prose in his communication with the Prime Minister.
10th of September, 1962. Confidential. Prime Minister, thank you for your minute of 3rd of September on Ariel, unfortunately damaged by Caliban as he girdled the earth. He cost us an identifiable £200,000 for equipment, tracking, etc. As he cost the Americans rather more than £2 million, they built the box, provided the solar batteries, gave us the rocket and conducted the launch, we have not done so ill. We have a great deal out of him during his life, short but neither nasty nor brutish, in the shape of a large number of data, not yet fully analysed but said to be important. Before his accident, he had transmitted for approximately 1,000 hours, and it will take at least a year to analyse the significance of what he has said. Although badly wounded in his solar paddles, the organ which recharges his ability to speak, he is not quite dead. He still utters intermittently, sometimes intelligibly, and he is listened to by our monitors with respect. He may still improve sufficiently to tell us something of value, though he can hardly say, "Merrily shall I live now." The actual explosion, which damaged him, did provide valuable scientific as well as military results, and Ariel played a gallant part in obtaining these. This is illustrated by an urgent request from the United States to send representatives of our experimenters over next week to take part in a classified discussion on the results. Incidentally, you may be interested to know that those mysterious garments of the Earth, the Van Allen belts, have not actually been destroyed. Our mother, the Earth, has instead required, mysteriously, a new belt, somewhat lower down than Van Allen's. Hailsham.
It's a good testament to those people, the foresight that we carried on. We stuck with the story, carried on, built Ariel 2, Ariel 3, and our entire space program now builds on the foundations that were established back then.
David Parker, Doug Millard and Barney Wells there reading the extracts. And in a wonderful display of serendipity, it turned out that Barney's father was a civil servant and his father's boss was Lord Hailsham.
There's some really strong diplomatic language in there, wasn't it? It's really rather remiss of the United States not to tell the UK.
And Ariel misbehaving. And in fact, it was quite nice. We were all sort of chortling away when we heard the florid, beautiful language. What did you make of what you've just heard there, David?
It was a marvellous display of the naivety, to a great extent, of the British scientists that were involved, that to an extent, they were on the outside edge of something that was happening in the United States. This was a time when the US Air Force was very angry at the formation of NASA. The US Air Force had attempted to seize total control of all space projects, and they were going to go ahead and do their own experiments, come what may. And if those fuzzy-haired scientists at NASA wanted to involve people from over the pond in the United Kingdom, heaven forbid, in involving them in scientific research, then that was nothing to do with them. And the real objective in the Starfish operation was that there was very great concern in the United States about the survivability of satellites in time of war. And, of course, this is right at the very early phase of the deployment of ICBMs. And there was a concept whereby you could prematurely detonate incoming Soviet warheads by massive neutron bombardment from electromagnetic radiation released from atomic explosions up in the stratosphere, out in space. And so there's a very logical military reason, totally confounding the aspirations of the scientists, as to why that should actually happen.
So actually, Ariel 1 was actually part of their experiment.
And nobody over here in the UK knew about that.
Gosh, that's that's interesting. Kate, do you agree with David Parker at the end there, where he said, effectively, in a typically sort of British way, things don't quite always work out how you feel, but we came out in the end, and this is where all our space endeavours sort of began?
Well, I agree with the language that we've just heard is amazing, and I love the way that they've taken that sort of Shakespearean tone. I mean, Ariel itself was named from a character in The Tempest, and it seems like quite a tempestuous event went on there. I can't help but thinking it's somewhat ironic in a way that having, you know, thought for so many years that Russia was the very secretive space power, that actually it's one of our allies that we're supposed to be working with who's keeping all the secrets from us.
Incidentally, to commemorate the UK's 50 years in space, there's now a small exhibition dedicated to Ariel 1 at the Science Museum in London, and it can be found where else? In its space gallery.
Well, here at Space Boffin's headquarters, we're not short on ambition. And in that spirit, in partnership with the BBC Future website, we've bought our own spacecraft.
Well, yeah, that makes it sound like it's huge. Tell them how big it is, Rich.
It's the size of two postage stamps.
But it's still a spacecraft.
It's still a spacecraft. This Sprite will be ejected, along with around 100 others, from a small satellite known as a CubeSat, which is being put together by a team led by Cornell University student Zach Manchester. Well, Zach raised the money for the project from donations, and construction starts this summer. Well, I've been speaking to Zach via the internet, and I first asked him to describe what the CubeSat will look like.
Our CubeSat is something like a loaf of bread size. The center box, if you will be what we call a spacecraft bus, and it'll have all the sort of essential subsystems for making everything work. It'll have a flight computer and some attitude control hardware for pointing the CubeSat, and also a power system, communication system for talking to the ground, all that sort of stuff. Then the outer two boxes, if you will be deployment mechanisms for our Sprite chipsats, for our tiny chipsats. So there'll be stacks of chipsats of Sprites in the outer two boxes on sort of a spring-loaded pusher. We'll be able to trigger those from the ground. So we'll give a command for each one of those individually to open up and deploy all the Sprites.
And what will these Sprites do? They're about the size of a postage stamp, or a couple of postage stamps, is that right?
So they're a couple of postage stamps. They're about 3.5 centimeters by 3.5 centimeters square. They're little tiny circuit boards. So they have solar cells on them, and then they have a microcontroller, which is a tiny computer on a chip, then a radio and a magnetometer and a gyroscope. So right now they're intended really for a technology demonstration to prove that we can actually fly something this small and communicate with it from the ground and get usable data off of it. They can measure the Earth's magnetic field with a magnetometer, and they can also measure their spin behavior using the gyroscope, so we can tell how they're oriented, basically, relative to the Earth's magnetic field, which is a relevant and interesting piece of data. So they sort of transmit that data back to the ground using their radio, and we can identify them uniquely. We can tell which Sprite it is that we're hearing from based on their signals.
And so, although this is a demonstrator, this actually could have some scientific potential. You could use these for scientific experiments or a future mission.
Absolutely, yeah.
And this whole project has really captured people's imagination, hasn't it?
I suppose it has, yes. One of the unique aspects of this is that we've managed to get these things into a sort of size range where they're actually cheap enough to build and launch that the average person could, you know, feasibly afford to do one of these on their own. So it really brings access to space to a whole new segment of the population. It brings it out of the realm of, say, governments or universities or militaries, and really into the realm of sort of the hobbyist. I mean, I really think that we're starting to see the beginnings of this personal space age. You hear it all the time, and you know, in reference to things like Virgin Galactic, where for only, you know, a few $100,000 you can have a ride to space. But I'm talking about hundreds of dollars and being able to put your own thing in space that you own. So I think that's sort of a powerful idea, and it's a very new concept. And I'm we've definitely, you know, seen a lot of people get interested and excited about that, and I'm hopeful that it continues and that we can advance this idea of personal spaceflight and get more people involved in space.
Zach Manchester talking to me from Cornell University in New York State after he'd just spent the morning digging his car out of a snowdrift. And we'll be following the project closely both here and on the BBC Future website, which, rather annoyingly, you can only view if you're outside the UK or, and I need to whisper this, use a proxy server. David Baker and Kate Arklis-Gray are our studio guests. Kate, I guess you're very much part of this personal space age.
Well, I'd certainly like to be. That's, I mean, my aim is to be in space somehow myself.
You're not going to fit into a CubeSat, though, are you?
No, sadly not. CubeSats are, I think, what, 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres, and were based originally, I believe, on the size of a Beanie Baby box. So, no. Probably not. I am a little bit small, but I'm not quite that small.
Now, a lot of people have been celebrating, David, the 30th anniversary of the ZX Spectrum and this era of the home computer hobbyist. Is this what's happening in space now, that people are doing the same thing?
I think it is, and I think it's really exciting. And there's a graduated flow to these sprites and these... I mean, we've had nanosats. Now we've got super nanosats, essentially, is what we're talking about. And if you look back over the last 25 years, it's what's been coming. It's like a tsunami that's been gathering energy. And finally, it's hit shoreline. And hello, that's where all the folks are. And they're going to be taking advantage of that. And it's really great. I envisage a time, and this is Arthur C. Clarke world here, when we'll have thousands of these things that are all creating a social net or a work net in space that are greater than the sum of their parts.
So again, the analogy with computing, you've got cloud computing. Now,
exactly.
You don't need a big computer.
No.
You have lots of little computers
yes,
all over the
and
place.
And all of us are part of it. I mean, we're all TV stations now, you know, with video cams and with our laptops. So we're soon all going to be space entrepreneurs.
I should say with these, because that raises the whole issue of space debris, which we've talked about on this podcast, that these will, their orbit will decay over a few weeks and they will all burn up in the atmosphere. Because that's an issue, isn't it? When everyone starts launching their own satellites, no one has control.
That's the health warning reassurance, that they do biodegrade out of the danger zone of, where in fact, I mean, even a little object the size of a postage stamp moving along at those velocities can ruin your entire day, as somebody has said frequently many times.
Does that not worry you, Kate, though, that actually this could take you further away from your aim if it's going to be a case of everybody gets into space for themselves, but actually not in person, but through getting their own spacecraft, their little mini satellite?
It's sort of yes and no. I think really it's a really exciting time. I mean, to be able to do sort of short-term missions, 2 or 3 weeks, that's something that you could do at school. You know, classrooms could get involved in that. Then you get a whole new generation of people who are excited by space, engineering, maths, technology. And, you know, hopefully then they'd want to learn more about it and would need, I don't know, maybe a journalist to come up there and tell them what it's really like. You know, not everybody can go to space, so I just like to be the one who does.
David, I want to move on to the other end of the spectrum. And we've spent $300 on this sprite, which we hope will fly into space. I mean, that means we haven't been able to eat for a few days, but fine, we've got a spacecraft.
That's incredibly cheap, though, isn't it?
It is, amazingly cheap. Yeah. Then there's the other end of the spectrum, where you've got these millionaires, these billionaires, suddenly going into space flight, inspired seemingly by
it's hobby
Apollo.
Hobby space for some of them, I suspect.
Yes, and I guess what we're talking about here are the entrepreneurial startups, the Elon Musks and people like that, who are getting in on the ground floor, and they're applying sound business logic. Very, very smart guys, smart programs, smart business plans and strategies. At one end of the scale, that's really what the whole space world needs, a pretty big shake-up. But don't get too overexcited on this, because all we're doing is shifting the contracts from the big boys, the dinosaurs, to the agile little mammals.
What about this asteroid mining mission, which has the likes of James Cameron, the film director, behind it? This idea to develop robotic craft, eventually to go to an asteroid, eventually to exploit that and bring those materials back to Earth. I mean, it sounds barking mad to me.
I would say, now you're really talking. Not barking mad,
yeah,
but
I don't
that's
think it's
the real
mad.
That's yeah. the real future, yeah. and that's real entrepreneur. If there are companies, and there's a gap between the amount of money which government coffers can throw at projects like Apollo Shuttle Space Station, and which so far we're seeing from the touristy type thing, which is not really space travel, such as the Branson thing, up through the clever guys who are privatising space vehicles, that gap is now closing if they can mobilise the resources. NASA itself is looking on the way to Mars with the Orion spacecraft and the Space Launch System whether to go moon next or asteroid next.
I must admit, though, although I can see it happening, and it's almost like every science fiction film you've ever seen as well, particularly Blade Runner, I can't help feeling slightly worried about it as well and concerned, because it feels like we're a plague of locusts and that we're mining our own planet out of all its resources, so let's go and take something from elsewhere without really thinking about the possible consequences. It's like the Wild West again. And although the arguments for this have been, well, without exploration, as in the past, from mining for gold or what have you, you got your transport systems, your infrastructure. That's also forgetting, yes, but you also destroyed indigenous peoples. You trampled over the rights of local people. What did you do to the environment? And I feel that's being in the literature that you read about it, in the press releases that they bring out, that's never mentioned or addressed. And we have to learn from our mistakes in the past. Kate, you've been to SpaceX. You're going to their latest launch. I know you were quite impressed with them, weren't you, in terms of what their aims and what they were trying to do. But it's not the only sort of, I hate to use the word exploitation again, but that's the phrase that seems to be used, the sort of exploitation of space that's going to take place.
I think it's interesting what you said there. I mean, that is the kind of flip side. You know, in one sense, it's really excellent that there's going to be more access to space, that more people are going to have the chance perhaps to go up there, that we can bring the costs down. And, I mean, one of the problems that I've always felt with NASA is it's just so untouchable. To normal people, you know, I always say it's like Father Christmas. You know it exists, but you're never going to meet him. You know, the same with astronauts. I mean, I've been lucky enough to have actually met some of these people, and suddenly it becomes real. So, yeah, I mean, I think with more people doing space stuff and being excited about it, that's great. But, yeah, the flip side is, who are these people and who will be regulating
them? Where does this leave, David, the big space agencies?
Well, I think there'll always be a role for them, and clearly there are things for which there is no commercial return. And I think, in fact, it links in with what Susan was saying, that implicit within the human equation is a driving need to go to the next horizon and see the one beyond that. And the psychological and the philosophical implications of this seeming rampant surge into the solar system, I think, is one of the big challenges for balancing our priorities and the way we take our societies and move them into a space-based culture. Because once the genie is out of the bottle, it truly will be impossible to put it back. And I think we live on a three-Earth planet now, don't we, in that to live to the standards of even the normalised subsistence of an ordinary middle-class Western family, we need three Earth's resources. So we're outliving ourselves already. But I think that the national programmes for space exploration, such as planetary research, you're not going to find many companies wanting to do long-period, decadal surveys of the solar system, except for the overall mapping of those resources.
I think I'd rather have NASA exploiting, if we're going to use that word, asteroids or the moon, for all its faults.
Accountability.
Because it's accountable and it's essentially democratic, as opposed to the big corporations and certainly, you know, someone like James Cameron.
But the genie's already out of the bottle as regards to the moon, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's the Google Lunar X Prize. There are all sorts of teams trying to get rovers up onto the moon. And I've just heard that Astrobotic, one of the teams that are competing with that, have got an agreement with NASA to do some expeditions and prospecting around the southern lunar pole. I think the difference between a business doing that and maybe a governmental organisation doing it, you know, if it's NASA doing it or ESA doing it, you can always say, well, there's probably the basis for this is science or exploration or furthering our knowledge. When it's a company with a bottom line and shareholders...
It's money.
It's money.
It is like Blade Runner, isn't it?
It is indeed. Yeah.
And don't forget, actually, that all this comes under the 1962 Space Act, and that only controls governments. And in many ways, because essentially nobody can own these places, everybody can go there, and that may be the devil in the detail.
Well, before we go, let's have a bit more space history. We're approaching the 50th anniversary of the launch of America's second manned mission into orbit, Aurora 7. The astronaut on board was Scott Carpenter. Now, it became a controversial mission, notorious even, within the programme. Carpenter splashed down some 250 miles off course, and he's been criticised publicly for getting distracted in orbit and ending up behind schedule. So, from 1962... the launch of Scott Carpenter.
Downrange and around the world, the recovery forces are on station. 20 ships, 110 aircraft, 13,000 Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps personnel, all standing by for a lone American in a silver spacesuit.
Your attention, please. All personnel, please clear the test stand area. To the roadblock.
While the actual launch is controlled from a windowless concrete blockhouse near the launch pad, the Mercury Control Center, farther away, is the nerve center from which all elements of the mission are managed.
Status check. Missile power.
Go.
RF system.
RF record. Go.
Propulsion.
Go.
AMR telemetry.
Go.
Telemetering quality.
Go.
Tell me how we are.
Mercury capsule.
Go.
9 10 9 8 7 6 5 4 3 2 1 0.
I feel the liftoff. The clock has started.
Roger.
Loud and clear, Gus.
Roger, Roy. Stand by for the timeout.
4 minutes. Aurora 7 is go. Fuel and oxygen steady. Cabin holding 25 amps. Power is good.
Roger, Aurora 7.
It's still incredibly exciting. The launch of Scott Carpenter on board Aurora 7 in May 1962.
Well, I interviewed about 15 years ago Chris Kraft, notorious flight director at Mission Control, particularly at the time of the Mercury missions, and he was so unbelievably rude about Carpenter. I was quite shocked at the time because it was the first time I'd heard somebody from NASA slag off his own astronauts.
See, I've always felt he's actually one of my favourite astronauts, because when you read the transcripts or listen to bits of archive like that, he's incredibly eloquent. He has beautiful descriptions of what's going on, and I suspect that's how he got behind schedule, apart from the technical problems that he was blamed for at the time, which turned out to not be his fault.
Yeah, I think in retrospect, you know, you have to accept that there was a huge war going on in NASA between science and engineering, and the flight director teams were very much engineering oriented. They did not want scientists in there. But I believe that one of them crept in on the Mercury 7, and his name was Scott Carpenter. And I think he's, with a small s, he was NASA's first space scientist and preceded Jack Schmidt by a decade to the year, when Jack Schmidt went on the moon as the only formal space scientist that had been recruited to the astronaut program. And I think Scott Carpenter was vilified because of that all the way through. But when you go down and see what he's done in underwater research down in off the Florida Keys, he's done a tremendous amount for science.
Well, we're going to have to end it there. But before we do, Kate, I believe congratulations are in order in terms of where you're off to. Let us know.
I'm off to the International Space University. I've been thinking I'll get a T-shirt that says, "I'm going to space," and then have in very small letters, "University."
And what it'd will, be really what disappointing that the International Space University is not actually
in space.
Space,
yeah. So it's Florida, isn't it? And yeah. What will it involve? How long will you be there for?
I'm going to be in Florida for 9 weeks. We'll be studying at the Florida Institute of Technology and at Kennedy Space Center and learning everything from kind of orbital dynamics to
You'll know when you get
there.
Everything. Well, thanks very much to our guests, Kate Arklis-Gray and David Baker. The Space Boffins podcast is produced by Boffin Media with support from the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium and a grant from the UK Space Agency.
Do follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we'll post some pictures of today's recording and some extracts of those Ariel 1 papers. If you like the Space Boffins podcast, please do tell your friends. And thanks for listening.